Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now. Racism is a serious public health threat. That's the new assessment by the head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It's something many Americans have known too well for years, and it's become increasingly apparent during a pandemic that has disproportionately harmed people of color. Health disparities extend far beyond COVID-19, sometimes starting at the very beginning of life. The CDC has found black infants are twice as likely to die as non-Hispanic white babies. Other serious health inequities include higher rates of illness and death from diabetes, obesity, and heart disease for people of color. Joining us now is Dr. Jewel Mullen, Associate Dean for Health Equity at Dell Medical School at the University of Texas, Austin. Dr. Mullen, welcome back.
Thank you, Callum.
So I know this connection between racism and public health is certainly not news to you since you study health equity, and more than 150 state and local governments have already made this declaration. But I wonder, since you previously held a leadership position in the Department of Health and Human Services, how significant you think it is for a federal agency like the CDC to weigh in?
Callum, I consider this declaration as having unfolded in a long time coming framework. We've been waiting for this for a long time. And to have the Centers for Disease Control make this statement calls upon all of us to do what a lot of scientists have used to push back against the notion that racism actually is a public health or health issue. We often say,
what do you make of the timing right now?
The timing is I won't even say overdue. It's an opportunity that ought not be squandered. It's especially timely because we've had, as you say, state and local entities declaring racism as a public health issue. And we've heard statements from lots of private sector leaders declaring anti-racism postures. The question is, how do they define that, and what are they going to do about that? The CDC...
Yeah, there's a difference between postures and deliverables. I want to dig in, as you mentioned that, what the promises are the CDC has made that are attached to this declaration. It says, for example, that it plans to continue studying how racism impacts public health. How would you rate the state of affairs right now, current efforts to understand and research what's really happening?
There are two ways of looking at it. One is that we've spent too much time ignoring what's before us. So those who still have a hard time looking at the news this week and observing what's happened in Minneapolis, for example, and being troubled to see the relationship between race, racism, and the death of another black man, can't keep turning away from those possibilities. But at the same time, everyone who says, prove it and prove the solutions that work, now will be provided through the work that CDC can do with what some people say they need, the evidence. That's really important as well. We spend a lot of time...
There's a financial component to this too, Dr. Mullen. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but
that's okay.
The CDC says it's going to expand investments in disproportionately affected communities. And I'm wondering if you controlled the purse strings, what would you do with that money? What would be an ideal target for federal funding in your mind?
We need systems change at the same time that we need more strategic programmatic investments. Systems changes enable us to do things such as arm agencies to actually collect data. We've been talking about poor data in testing for COVID, understanding cases and fatalities associated with COVID, for example. So setting up those systems is important. Along with that, creating leadership positions in every agency to actually shepherd this work along, including training the leaders to actually be the sponsors of it, because that doesn't always happen. At the same time that we continue to strategically support people who's have housing and food insecurity, need more stability and improved education, for example, and better access to healthcare by linking health care systems and public health systems better. Monies can be used for that as well.
So in the moment we have left, how would you measure progress? Because as you mentioned a moment ago, sometimes the data is lacking. How will we know whether this effort is successful?
The first thing that we have to do is truly and meaningfully get behind it. For a few years now, we've talked about the centuries of inequality that have created the inequities responsible for the disparities that you noted at the beginning of this segment. So we know that already. What we have to do over time is stay with the work, continue to stay with it, and push forward. This cannot be a moment that people are interested in right now because of what's happened in the pandemic and with violence.
Dr. Jewel Mullen, we'll have to leave it there. I'm sorry. The Associate Dean for Health Equity at Dell Medical School at UT Austin. Dr. Mullen, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, few places know how race and public health intersect, like the Navajo Nation, which last May had the highest per capita COVID-19 infection rate in the country. Today, health officials reported just one new death and 15 new cases. And there have been days recently when those numbers have been at or near zero. This remarkable turnaround is no doubt in part because one of the most successful vaccination campaigns in the country. Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez joins us now. Mr. President, welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having us on the show.
When you see case numbers, new case numbers in the single digits or even as low as zero on some days, does that tell you that you're out of the woods? I mean, do you think this crisis is over on the Navajo Nation?
Well, no, we're not out of the woods yet. You know, I mean, all across the country, you're starting to see a rise in cases once again. And these variants are starting to pop up closer. We just announced last week that the UK variant was identified in the western part of the Navajo Nation. And just recently, we announced that the California variant is also been identified here on the Navajo Nation. But, you know, with the contact tracers, they have been doing awesome. They isolated these two incidences. And, you know, we are hopeful that we are going to transition out of this pandemic soon with 246,465 vaccines doses coming to the Navajo Nation. 211,298 have gone into the arms of our Navajo people. So that's 85.7% of what we receive have gone into the arms of our citizens. And
let's talk about that. I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just want to get in here for a second. Let's talk about that. Now, you vaccinated more than half of your population. You have a vaccination rate that is ahead of every U.S. state. How did you do that?
I contribute that to the Navajo people for allowing the vaccine to go into their arms. You know, we've been having town hall meetings. We just had one today. And just getting the information to our Navajo people. And I think that is one of the reasons why we brought confidence in taking the vaccine. Of course, utilizing our way of life teaching also. You know, it's not about restricting our freedoms, wearing masks or following these tough protocols. It's about the greater good.
So are you saying that you didn't get the pushback that we have seen so often from other communities around the country with things like mask mandates and these lockdowns that you had on the Navajo Nation, strict lockdowns, stay-at-home orders that lasted up to 57 hours at a time over the summer?
You know, Dr. Fauci said it himself, you know, Navajo could be a model to push back on the virus in a regional approach. And, you know, we didn't get nobody protesting at our governments or at your local chapters about wearing their mask. You know, you could tell off the nation in our border towns, you know, Navajo people still wear masks while not others wear masks. So I think, yes, there is a time to celebrate, but also to be cautious as well. And that's why we're taking gradual steps in reopening here on the Navajo Nation.
We're all thrilled that you have this really solid vaccine rate, the best vaccine rate in the country for all intents and purposes. But as you well know, at one point, it was the exact opposite. The Navajo Nation had the worst COVID rates in the country. Many of your elders died. And historically, you know far better than I do, that Native people have suffered during pandemics and outbreaks in the history of this country. So how has this pandemic shaped and scarred your people over the last year?
I mean, For the Navajo people, you know, we've gone through some tough times. We've overcome smallpox, also tuberculosis outbreaks. And, you know, not too long ago, we had Hansa virus and COVID-19 now. And we've overcome each of those viruses. And, you know, over 1,200 of our Navajo people have lost their lives to COVID-19. Our thoughts and prayers go out to them. You know, we have high rates of diabetes, cardiovascular disease, cancers. You know, I was just on an interview earlier talking about over 500 uranium mines that are still open here on the Navajo Nation that contribute to cancer. And that's what we have to contend with here on our nation. But I think the Navajo people have learned a lot through this pandemic. At the beginning, you know, some of us leaders, we took the shot on television just to reassure our Navajo people that, you know, if we're telling our citizens to get the shot, then we better walk the talk. And that's what many of us did. And I think that also brought confidence to taking the vaccine as well.
Well, we wish you continued success fighting this disease and getting those shots into arms there on the Navajo Nation. Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez, thank you.
Thank you for having us. God bless.
Japan is raising its coronavirus alert level for Tokyo to deal with surging infections just 3 months before the Olympics are supposed to begin. The urgency in Japan coincides with spiking COVID-19 cases in another Asian country, South Korea. That's where NPR's Anthony Kuhn is. But Anthony, let's start with the situation in Japan. Why is COVID-19 surging there?
Well, as in many other countries, people here are exhausted. They're not following the rules too closely, and cases spike as soon as restrictions are eased. And the first places to see a surge were the first places to ease restrictions in early March after the third wave. The first place that really started was Osaka, and they had to cancel their leg of the Olympic torch relay because of the jump in cases. Tokyo eased restrictions later, and cases surged there, too. But, you know, it's so fast. It's only 3 weeks since they eased restrictions. And many experts argued that this would happen. Now they're predicting a fourth wave, even a fifth wave, which could even be in progress at the same time as the Olympics.
I see. And now we could go backwards to tougher restrictions. That's what raising the alert level in Tokyo allows officials to do. In practical terms, Anthony, what does that mean for people there?
Well, it means in Tokyo and as well as Kyoto and Okinawa, restaurants and bars in the most densely populated areas of town will have to close by 8 p.m. If they do that, they will get compensation. If they don't, they will get fined, and that's going to last about a month. What they did not want to do this time was impose another formal state of emergency, which would cover an entire prefecture, which is like a state. So this time it's targeted at specific cities, and they're calling it sort of a quasi-emergency. Osaka and some other prefectures went under these measures Monday, and they have in Osaka patrols going around to bars and restaurants enforcing them. But experts admit it's far from clear that these quasi-emergencies will really do the trick.
And of course, one of the big factors here is that the vaccine rollout in Japan has been rather slow. In fact, we're reading that only about 1% of the Japanese population has been vaccinated. Why the holdup there, Anthony?
Yeah, that 1% are people who have gotten at least one dose, but fully vaccinated people account for 0.1%. One of the reasons they're having problems is vaccine scares. For example, in the 1990s, they had side effects and deaths associated with the mumps, measles, and rubella vaccine. There was a class action lawsuit. The government lost. And after that, they stopped making childhood immunizations mandatory. They only recommended them. So critics say this has contributed to a low level of trust towards new vaccines.
So that's the situation in Japan. But meanwhile, Anthony, you're in South Korea, which earlier this week reported the highest daily new infection total in 3 months. What's going on there, and how is the pandemic affecting life at this moment in South Korea?
Well, South Korea is also on the brink of a fourth wave, but they got their third wave under control 3.5 months ago. But they couldn't get the case numbers down very far. They kept hovering. There's a lot of undetected community transmission going on. So now they have to extend social distancing and a ban on gatherings of 5 people or more for an additional 3 weeks. And as in Japan, they're trying to sort of calibrate things instead of an across-the-board tightening. And so they have very detailed requirements like a ban on handing out food samples at supermarkets. But again, people aren't sure that these will work.
That's NPR's Anthony Kuhn in Seoul with the latest on the pandemic in South Korea and also Japan. Anthony, thank you.
Thank you, Callum.
Back in December, I spoke with Harvard astronomer Alyssa Goodman, who just recently heard the news that Puerto Rico's Arecibo Observatory had collapsed.
Heartbroken is exactly the right word. I did my thesis, a lot of it, at Arecibo 30 years ago, but I have very fond memories.
For decades, Arecibo was the largest telescope of its kind, its platform suspended on cables high above a giant reflector dish in the forest. Its demise was a crushing blow to the scientists who worked there, but also to the people of Puerto Rico itself. Daniel Alarcón is a contributing writer at The New Yorker who's been writing about Arecibo's collapse. Daniel, welcome.
Thanks, Peter. It's great to be here.
Yeah, and why don't we start with this tape here from Ada Monzon, who is a meteorologist on WAPA-TV. She had just found out that the observatory had collapsed, and she's on TV announcing the news to her viewers.
Amigos, en una noticia de última hora, tengo que informarles y con el corazón en la mano que el observatorio de Arecibo colapsó. Se derrumbó, señores.
You don't really actually have to know what she's saying there to understand it. To hear the shock and the emotion in her voice, she's saying, with my heart in my hands, I have to tell you that the observatory collapsed. How does it represent how Puerto Ricans felt when the telescope fell?
It was like losing a family member. A lot of people told me that. It also, is, it's worth mentioning, is, you know, really beloved and respected in Puerto Rico. And she's covered all kinds of calamities on the island. And so for her to, you know, show that much emotion on the air, you know, this is a consummate professional, I think sort of speaks to the level of pain and hurt that losing an icon like Arecibo caused, not just Ada, of course, but everyone on the island.
Why? Why was it so important to people?
For a place like Puerto Rico to have a world-class facility like that, it gave people permission to dream, you know? And that sounds a little bit sort of far-flung, but I found that a lot of astronomers sort of are given to grand emotions, which makes sense if you know, you spend your life contemplating the cosmos. But I spoke to one guy named Abel Mendez, and he told me that, you know, for him, a working-class kid, he could dream of being a scientist because a place like that existed, and it was, you know, right there. It was his. There was a sense of belonging and a sense of ownership, and I think that's why it hurt so much.
And how did it come to be theirs in the 1960s?
You know, it's kind of one of these accidents of the Cold War. After the, you know, the launch of Sputnik, there was a sense that the U.S. was falling behind, and there's a lot of money coming out of the federal government to do big things that showed that the United States was still a player. There's an engineer from Cornell University named William Gordon who had this idea to study the upper atmosphere, and there could be traces of intercontinental ballistic missiles that you could see. And to do that, you would need a massive, massive telescope. He sold this idea to the federal government, a defense agency that was founded under Eisenhower, and set about finding a place to build it. And there was a student getting his PhD at Cornell who basically was like, hey, how about Puerto Rico? And they looked at a bunch of topographical maps, and they found in these limestone hills near Arecibo these big sinkholes that were sort of naturally shaped like giant dishes. And they essentially, and he says it himself in oral history, it sounds rather arbitrary, but we just picked one and that was it.
Were Puerto Ricans smitten from the beginning?
Yeah, I think it was in this colonial relationship that Puerto Rico has with the United States, this was the most tangible proof of a big investment. This was an iconic facility. It was money and commitment. It was world class. It was a part of popular culture, appearing in movies. It kind of has faded a bit now, in 2021. But in the 90s, they won a Nobel Prize. And when I say they, I mean, of course, there were scientists who won it. But there was a sense that it was from Arecibo. Arecibo won it, yeah. You know?
Well, to that point, I mean, in your article, you write that the telescope fueled 3,500 scientific publications and nearly 400 master's or PhD theses. More than 20 asteroids were studied from the observatory and named after scientists who worked there. What was its legacy, scientifically speaking?
There are important scientific achievements that we can name. The rotation of Mercury's orbit, or, you know, the surface of lots of near-Earth asteroids, or discovery of binary pulsars, like all these things, important discoveries that came out of Arecibo. An element of it that's almost unquantifiable is the number of Puerto Rican, Caribbean, Latin American, Latino scientists, youth who were inspired by its presence. There were still hundreds of scientists all over the world vying to use its facilities. Every day they were doing groundbreaking work. We're all a little bit less safe without Arecibo. The near-Earth asteroids of the kind that, you know, could wipe out a city, Arecibo was tasked with mapping these and learning just exactly what kind of risk we're in, and that's gone.
It does sound, though, that its decline was gradual and had been happening for some years, including in the early 2000s when the National Science Foundation was facing some financial problems and had to cut its budget. Is it your sense that that was the beginning of the end for Arecibo?
Yeah, and it's not just my sense. I think there's general agreement on that. Kind of tragically, the budget cuts at the NSF coincided with kind of the decline of the Puerto Rican economy as well. And so there's a real correlation there that sort of feels like one giant process of decline.
So hearing what you're saying about the legacy of this observatory on the island itself and the people who live there, but also on science, I just wonder if it's too far of a stretch to say that the loss of this observatory is somehow a metaphor for the history of this island and the relationship it's had with the United States over the years.
I think there's a temptation to do that for sure. I also think it's not the full story of what's happening in Puerto Rico and the rebirth and the resilience of the people there. There's no escaping the hurt and the loss and the sense of tragedy to lose something so iconic and so beloved. There's just no way to escape that.
Do you think that something will replace it, that it will be rebuilt somehow?
I hope so. I was so moved by the voices of the people, you know, Puerto Ricans specifically, and the scientific community around Arecibo, the love they had for this facility. And it seems to me a terrible shame that it won't be replaced. It would be really, really, really just very sad.
Daniel Alarcón is a contributing writer at The New Yorker and executive producer of Radio Ambulante. We're going to link you to his article at hereandnow.org. Daniel, thank you so much.
Thanks, Peter. Appreciate it.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
On NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast, we talk about movies, music, and more, like why The Great Pottery Throwdown is a comforting binge watch, and a look back at some of Chadwick Boseman's essential performances. All of that in around 20 minutes every weekday. Listen now to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
We're following sad news today from Great Britain.
A short while ago, Buckingham Palace announced the death of His Royal Highness Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh.
The BBC reporting the death of Prince Philip, Queen Elizabeth II's husband. He died this morning at Windsor Castle. He was 99 years old. BBC political correspondent Rob Watson joins us. Rob, I know reactions are pouring in. How is Prince Philip's death resonating there?
Well, you wouldn't be surprised that there's been sympathy expressed and condolences to the Queen from every dimension of the political and public spectrum here in the UK. There's been an outpouring of messages of remembrance, and certainly back to the political classes, the sort of sense of an extraordinary life, well lived, and extraordinary in providing such a support to the Queen for such an extraordinary long time. Indeed, he was the longest consort in the long, very long history of the British monarchy.
73 years, and as you say, it was very much a supporting role as the Queen's husband. It really defined his life, also restricted it in some ways, Rob. But in that role, he fulfilled some 20,000 royal engagements, we're seeing. I mean, how did he conduct himself in this role?
Yes, I mean, a quite extraordinary role, and all the more extraordinary if you think about it, that there's nothing written down in the British Constitution. There's no handbook for what he should do. It's not like being, I don't know, the Vice President or the Leader of the Senate. He had to make this up. And of course, coming into the role came as a shock to both him and to the Queen, because if you think about it, he was very young. He was only just about in his early 30s. The Queen's father had died young of lung cancer, and suddenly they found themselves, she as Queen, he as consort to the Queen. How did he do it? I think in the first instance it was difficult. As I say, it was a shock to suddenly find yourself from being, as he was, a senior naval officer to suddenly being, if you like, second to the Queen. But he managed. I mean, after undoubtedly a difficult few months and perhaps difficult few early years, I think it's undoubtedly the case that the modern royal family, the royal family would not have endured from the 1950s when he took up that role until his death without him.
Well, how did he make his mark then, Rob? Because as you pointed out, he was very much aware of his place. In fact, he once said that constitutionally, I don't exist, although the Queen did refer to him as her rock. But how did he make his own impact, apart from just being a ceremonial consort?
Well, I think publicly and privately that the public sector was just being this very visible representative of the royal family and all of those trips that you mentioned overseas, but of course being the head of countless charities and voluntary organisations here in the UK. I think perhaps the private function is just as important. And I think that was to provide, first of all, just astonishing longevity, good genes for just being around so long for the Queen. But also, I suspect, important advice. And I think he was quite a canny and clever operator. And I think that Prince Philip played a huge role in trying to get this balance right between the mystique that you need in order for monarchy to continue, right? I mean, you can't have monarchy if people don't go, wow, that's amazing, they live in a palace. But somehow balancing that with this idea that the royal family needed to be a bit more modern, that it needed to be aware of public relations. So, for example, in the 1960s, it was Philip's idea to invite the television cameras in, but to always try and get that balance, to keep the media at a sort of distance, to keep the mystique there, but also to let them in just a bit.
That's the BBC's Rob Watson. Rob, thank you.
Thank you.
Line workers and electricians laying transmission lines for a modern grid, providing over 500,000 charging stations on the highways we are going to build to accommodate electric vehicles so we can own the future.
The president wants to spend $174 billion on electric vehicle infrastructure. Nora Naughton is watching. She covers the auto industry for the Wall Street Journal. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You know, this push for electric vehicles isn't just coming from the government. A lot of the big automakers have also announced their plans for electric cars. So put this pledge from Biden into context. What does it mean for the industry?
Yeah, so actually this shift has sort of been a long time coming. And it's partially because you cannot engineer these vehicles overnight. They're very complex. But largely it's because this is such a globalized industry now. And other countries like China and Europe have already introduced more stringent emissions regulations that the companies have to adhere to. And what this means now in the U.S. is that the auto industry finally has to commit these vehicles to the American market, which has always been more unique. We like big trucks, SUVs. These require bigger, more expensive batteries. And so that's why you start to see this push from the automakers here to give us not the Chevy Bolt, not the Prius, but, you know, something that looks more like the gas-powered cars that Americans already eat up, like an electric Silverado or an F-150.
So what's the state of that effort? You know, because really, if you look at the numbers, I think 1% of vehicles on the road today in the United States are electric. It's niche, right?
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. And some of that is there hasn't been a big commitment by the car companies to sell these in the U.S. yet because they just don't make money on them. But, you know, the other thing that's holding it back is something that's a little bit more out of the auto industry's control, which is the infrastructure, you know, places to fuel these cars. The car companies have figured out this big engineering riddle of building a battery that can last you just about as many miles as a full tank of gas. But then when you have to recharge that battery, it's not quite as simple as filling up your tank.
Right. So, you know, it's what you're getting at is exactly what the Biden administration is trying to do with this infrastructure bill. It's got grants, loans, tax credits to encourage exactly what you're talking about there. Is that going to do it? What do you think of those proposals?
I think it's a really complicated problem to solve. So what a lot of EV owners have today are, you know, they've completely changed the infrastructure of their homes. You know, they install charging stations in their garage or in their driveway, and you charge overnight. being on a road trip and like stopping for 10 minutes to refill your tank is just not how it works in an electric car. I mean, I took a road trip.
How long does it take?
Oh, it can take a long time. I took a road trip in a Chevy Bolt 2 winters ago before the pandemic. And there were times where I was sitting at a charger for hours, like 4 hours.
Wow. Okay, that's going to be a challenge, right? And so is price. Price is going to be a major challenge. At what point will it be that an electric vehicle is competitive with a gas-powered car? Because that nothing's going to change until that happens.
Sure, price is a big issue, but that is a little bit of a loaded question because even gas-powered cars are getting super expensive right now. That's not to say that the car companies aren't trying to bring down the cost of electric cars. But like GM, for example, says they're aiming to reduce battery cell costs to under $100 per kilowatt hour, which is sort of like miles per gallon, by 2025. And that would compare with the $150 per kilowatt hour that they have on their batteries today. So there is a push to bring down these costs, but overall in the industry, cars are just getting more expensive because these gas-powered cars that are already on the road are loaded with a lot of the tech that the EVs have, just with a gas-powered engine.
Well, and the companies will say over the course of time, those electric vehicles are going to be cheaper to maintain. So it's hard. You got to do the calculation. Now, we've been talking about electric cars for many, many years, and we don't know what parts of Biden's proposal are going to make it into law. But do you think it signals a turning point for EVs in this country, or are we just going to be having the same conversation here 5 years from now?
The announcements from the Biden administration are sort of definitely a turning point, but almost like a period at the end of the sentence in this turning point. This is a direction that the auto industry has been going in for the better part of a decade now. And we're really, for the last 4 years, sort of waiting for the shoe to drop on emissions regulations. The Trump administration was very wishy-washy on what they wanted to do. And all the car companies have been asking for in the American market is a direction to run in. And now they have one. And so I think you'll start to see, you know, all of these sort of promises are going to start to come to fruition because they have, you know, a commitment from the government to support them in this shift.
Until there's a new government. That's Nora Naughton. She's a reporter government. For the Wall Street Journal. Thank you very much.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
As we heard, President Biden's plan promises to install 500,000 vehicle charging stations before the end of the decade, up from about 100,000 in use now. And that's probably going to be good for businesses like Jonathan Levy's. He's an executive at EVgo, an LA-based electric vehicle charging company. Jonathan, welcome to you.
Thanks, Peter.
And we just heard a reporter from the Wall Street Journal say that charging an electric car that she took on a road trip a couple years ago took several hours. Have we advanced from that point yet?
So a lot has changed in the last couple years, and a lot is going to continue to change in electric vehicles. So just in the last 2 years, we've seen a shift where before, you know, 50 kW was kind of the peak for fast charging for a lot of the vehicles. Now with the Hyundai Kona, the Kia Niro, obviously the Tesla Model 3, but also the new vehicles coming out for the next generation, even the new Nissan Leaf Plus, the Ford Mach-E, the Hyundai Ioniq 5, those can charge at higher power rates. And so as a result, you can cut down that time.
I think your industry is all about ramping up. So how many charging stations have you built recently and where are they?
EVgo today has more fast charging locations than any other public charging network. We have more than 800 locations across 34 states, 67 metropolitan markets. And obviously, we're not the only ones out there. But 130 million Americans are within a 10-mile drive of an EVgo fast charger today. And given that the bulk of the charging activity today is happening in California, it's not surprising that that's where the bulk of our installations and throughput are. But we're building everywhere. We're building in Virginia. We're building in Florida, Illinois, all sorts of places.
Well, and you've got to if this is going to work. And President Biden seems to know this, too. He's calling for at least 500,000 EV chargers in the United States by 2030. Is it your understanding that companies like yours will be getting money from the government under this plan if it passes to build this infrastructure?
The American Jobs Plan has a lot of great what we call policy tailwinds, which is something we've seen happening at the state and local level for a long time, and the federal government taking a leadership role is a great thing. We often hear people complaining about the chicken and the egg problem when it comes to charging and EVs. We don't believe that's actually the apt metaphor, right? Chicken and the egg implies you're starting from scratch. We don't need to know what goes first because we have a base of charging. We have great EV models that are here. What we need now is peanut butter and jelly. We need complementary policies and complementary investments. You want the charging out there to enable adoption, and then you want enough vehicles using the charging to have a virtuous cycle of investment so that you generate revenue to reinvest and build more charging and continue to expand. If we can get more people behind the wheel, we know that they love it. There are very few of what I call EV recidivists, people who drive an EV and want to go back because the acceleration is better, the ride is smoother, it's quieter, it's cleaner. It's just a better way to drive. And so we have to do the education, we have to do the infrastructure build out, we have to get the incentives for adoption, and we have to get the marketing out there so that everybody knows, wow, there are really great cars and they're available today.
Well, speaking of incentives, you're a private company. Make the case why you and other businesses should get federal money to do this work. I mean, it's interesting because we're talking about the Biden administration saying they want to eliminate subsidies for the oil and gas industry.
Yeah, well, and I don't think you're asking me to defend the decades of subsidies for oil and gas and contrast them with the recent subsidies, but we're talking about...
No, but subsidies I am talking about, yeah, writ large.
Sure. There is obviously, though, a stark difference between legacy incumbent industries that have been receiving and continue to receive accelerated depreciation and other incentives and new emerging technologies that are helping internalize the externalities of climate in addition to providing the other public services. And I think at its core, though, Peter, it does take time to ramp, and we're at the early days of it. We know that we have to build out that infrastructure in tandem with the vehicle adoption, and we know that policy is really critical for the early parts of the industry to make sure we can get to the next level.
Jonathan Levy is Chief Commercial Officer of the EV charging company EVgo. Jonathan, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Peter.
Portland, Oregon's Collegiate Baseball League was born out of the pandemic last summer, and it's set to return for a second season. And this year, there's a new team, the Portland Rosebuds. The 2021 Rosebuds are inspired by a team of the same name that played in 1946. Oregon Public Broadcasting's Donald Orr reports on Portland's first and only all-black Negro League baseball team.
If you ever find yourself at Northwest 25th and Vaughn Street in Portland, you might think the area is pretty unassuming. This intersection is close to the industrial area of town and only a block from a residential neighborhood. But at this same spot 75 years ago, Portland's baseball team stepped up to home plate at Vaughn Street Park, a 12,000-seat wooden baseball stadium. Demolished in 1956, what's left of the park today is a commemorative plaque.
The plaque is just kind of standing on its own on the street corner here of 25th and Vaughn.
The plaque name drops a couple of teams from Portland's history in baseball, the Portland Webfooters, the Beavers, but it doesn't mention another team that briefly called Vaughn Street home, the 1946 Portland Rosebuds, the city's only Negro League baseball team. This summer, a new team will revitalize the name in honor of the original one. But getting info about the 46 Rosebuds has been difficult.
It was almost like it was erased from history, like it was just gone.
Alan Miller is co-owner of the Portland Pickles and marshal for Portland's Wild Wild West League, a summer collegiate baseball league which began last year.
People weren't, at that time, weren't willing to talk about them. They weren't willing to cover them. They weren't willing to support them. And that made it even harder.
From the few short news articles that can be found about the Portland Rosebuds, we know that many called them by their nickname, the Portland Roses. They were part of the West Coast Negro Baseball Association, a minor league that included the Seattle Steelheads and the Oakland Larks. And crucially, they played during a time when organized baseball was unofficially segregated. Raymond Doswell is vice president and curator of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum in Kansas City, Missouri.
Ultimately, in the end, there was never a written rule that would keep black players out. Just really collusion and racial attitudes and mores of the time that didn't welcome them.
Doswell says many Negro League teams didn't have the financial stability or support that white teams had. Plus, racist policies at the time made traveling for any black American difficult. Players sometimes had to sleep in their buses and bring their food with them because white-only hotels and restaurants wouldn't accept them.
We can lament the fact that blacks didn't get certain opportunities in baseball and other parts of society, but they chose to do it anyway because they loved it. So it isn't always what is being done to them. It's what they do to overcome this push at oppression and segregation.
even though the history is lost in some cases, Negro Leagues were important opportunities for black athletes, even outside of baseball. Take, for example, Olympic track star Jesse Owens.
The black baseball teams really helped Jesse Owens after the Olympics, his 36 Olympics. He was stripped of his amateur status and could no longer compete. The reasons were basically racism, that he was barred from further competition considering how successful he and his teammates were in Berlin.
The Rosebuds' main claim to fame was that Owens owned the team and ran the West Coast League with Harlem Globetrotters owner Abe Saperstein. Owens would publicize the games by sprinting against racehorses around the baseball field. But even with Owens' star power, it ultimately wasn't enough to keep the league sustainable. In 1946, the Rosebuds were supposed to play a full season of 110 games, but the West Coast League folded in just 2 months. Several different factors worked to kill the league. Negro League teams had to compete for time in stadiums primarily run by white teams. The money, it wasn't consistent. And the West Coast Negro League began right as Jackie Robinson was breaking baseball's color line and integrating into the majors.
One of the issues for the Negro Leagues ongoing is the attention that's going to suddenly turn to being paid to Robinson and others coming into the majors.
That's Leslie Heafy, Vice President of the Society for American Baseball Research and Associate Professor of History at Kent State University.
You're also talking about West Coast baseball, and West Coast baseball isn't major league at this stage yet, right? And so the attention being paid to baseball in general is not as much.
And then there's the inherent charm of playing baseball in the Pacific Northwest, where the games often got rained out. Today, the world knows about Owens and some of the best players to come out of the Negro Leagues. But most of the athletes who played in black leagues will never get the credit they deserve, says Raymond Doswell.
There won't ever be a full statistical record of the Negro Leagues. That's been lost to history. Statistics are a part of the story, but they're only a small part of the story. There are lots of other stories we can tell. I think it's more important for us to tell more of the human story and the black history story.
The new Rosebuds won't be exclusively black, but telling that history is part of what the league is trying to do this summer. Portland Pickles co-owner Alan Miller hopes that the new team serves as an opportunity to educate the community.
I think part of having a baseball team in Portland, there is a certain amount of responsibility that we have to understand the past. And if we can show people that, hey, this happened, this is a really important part of Portland's history, that's the first step.
Oh. The 2021 Rosebuds opened their inaugural season in June, rocking jerseys with a new Rosebuds logo. They hope to shine a light on an often overlooked but important chapter of Portland's storied history with baseball. For Here and Now, I'm Donald Orr.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Callum Borchers.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.